Hi everyone, today is a special episode on History Nerd Society podcast because it's in English, as you can hear. Mark Morris was kind enough to agree to an interview with me, and he will be the guest today, and I'm beyond thrilled. You can't imagine how excited I am to have him on the show. So have fun, everybody, and I hope you will enjoy this little different podcast. Welcome to the show. You can't imagine how thrilled I am to have you on History Nerd Society. I have your book right here, and this will be our topic today, the Anglo-Saxons.
Okay.
And my first question is, please tell me about the Saxons in general. How did they arrive in England?
Well, that's not easy to sum up quickly. It sort of starts in the prehistory. It starts in the 4th century. So if you're going back to the 400 years between sort of, say, the year 0 and 400, first 4 centuries, that's Roman Britain. Britain is part of the Roman Empire. And in the last century of Roman Britain is under attack by seaborne raiders, raiders from the north, raiders from the east, raiders from Ireland in the west. So people from the mainland, the continent, are attacking in the fourth century. After Britain leaves the Roman Empire, around the start of the fifth century, the number of people crossing the sea increases. And it's a very poorly documented period. We don't have really anything in the way of written records from the time. So we don't know precisely where they came from. We don't know precisely how many people came. And that's a matter of huge debate amongst archaeologists and historians as to whether it was hundreds of thousands of people or whether it was a tiny trickle.
Okay, thank you. And now please tell me about the time when England wasn't united and the different countries that were England.
I see what you mean. Okay, so yeah, so there's as my previous answer implies, there's no such thing as England at this point. What you have is the mess that's left by the collapsed state that was Roman Britain. And what we seem to see is a collapse into a galaxy of competing powers. So you've got lots of tiny little states, almost like sort of war bands, competing for power, maybe dozens, maybe hundreds even, in the immediate century after Roman collapse. But by the time you get to the late 6th century, so 150 years after that period, you can start to see the emergence of kingdoms. So there are regional kingdoms, as we would think of them now, regions of England, before England existed. Some of them are kingdoms that go on to form the basis of later counties. So I live in Kent, which is now a county within England, but that is a kingdom in its own right. Other kingdoms people might have heard of, like East Anglia, Mercia in the Midlands, Northumbria in the north, north of the River Humber, as its name implies, Wessex in the southwest. Now, they're all quite well known today in modern England, modern Britain. But they are the survivors of that process of competition. So, as I say, originally there were dozens and dozens of kingdoms, and they are the ones that emerge by the end of the 6th century and go on to jostle for power in the centuries that follow, so into the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries.
Okay, thank you. And my next question is, was Alfred the Great really great? Like, was he a successful monarch? Because I know that he got that nickname later.
As far as we can tell, in the first instance of him being described as great, Alfred Magnus, is the 13th century. And that name doesn't really, although it's repeated and it is used particularly in intellectual circles, it doesn't really become genuinely popular until the 18th century. So all the enthusiasm for Alfred the Great, or much of it, comes from a time when England is expanding overseas. You know, the British Empire is being forged. And that's when Alfred Mania really takes off. But as the fact that that name originates in the 13th century implies, he had a reputation even in the Middle Ages. And he had a reputation at the time for being an exceptionally skilled king. A lot of that rests, it's true, on the fact he has a contemporary biography. He's one of the few Anglo-Saxon rulers that for whom we have a contemporary portrait. And as you might imagine, because that's commissioned by or it's written by a bishop who was at Alfred's court, Bishop Asser, it's a piece of hagiography. It's written by a fan. It's written to praise Alfred. So, of course, it talks about how wonderful he was, how learned he was, how handsome he was, how he was a better fighter and a really just an all-round superhero. But in spite of the fact that we're viewing Alfred through that very positive prism, his accomplishments speak for themselves in that the other kingdoms that we just described of Anglo-Saxon England, East Anglia, Northumbria, Mercia, which is a really mighty kingdom, they all succumb in the course of the 9th century to the onslaught of the Vikings. So those kingdoms are effectively destroyed. And Wessex too, which is Alfred's kingdom, Wessex too is invaded and briefly conquered by the Vikings. But Alfred turns the ship around. Alfred succeeds in driving the Danes out of Wessex and ends up conquering, annexing half of Mercia. So he is the king that, you know, turned the tide in terms of the Viking invasions of England in the 8th and 9th centuries. And for that reason, that's one of the reasons he deserves his reputation. The other thing that makes him very exceptional is he was a great believer in learning and literacy. And that's part of his legacy as well, is having Latin texts translated into English and having them widely disseminated. So for those two reasons, I think Alfred deserves his reputation as a good thing.
Okay, and what do we know about the royal women in that time? For example, Ethelfled, Alfred's daughter. Or do you have an example for a powerful female in that time?
Well, we have examples. You've just cited a very good one, Ethelfled or Athelflaed, depending on how you say it. She was Alfred's daughter, and she was married in Alfred's day when she was quite young to the ruler, not a king, Alfred, the ruler of Mercia, who's called Ethelred. Alfred is quite clear that Ethelred isn't going to be king of Mercia. He's going to be a sort of an under king. He's going to be Alfred's deputy ruler or ealdorman. But he marries him to his own daughter, Alfred marries Ethelred to Alfred's daughter as a way of binding him close to Alfred's own power. She comes into her own when Ethelred dies. It's 909 or 910 he dies, and she continues to rule for another 8 years in her own right. She's referred to as Lady of the Mercians. So that might lead you to believe that these peoples, the Angles or the Saxons, sort of held women in high esteem. And that's always been, that's the traditional way since at least the 18th century of conceiving them, is, oh, women had better rights in this period. Look at Ethelfled. But in fact, what we know about her is very, very limited, because we've only got a handful, about half a dozen one-line chronicle entries about her. And in the West Saxon version of events, she's just written out of the story. And that's the sort of the thing that is less known, is people say, well, why aren't there more women in this book? The answer is because there is very little evidence for these women. I mean, between the early 8th century, when we have a writer called Bede, the Venerable Bede, who writes a big fat history of England down to his own day, mainly in the 7th century, he talks about one or two queens and female religious who are important. After that, we have no account of any woman of any consequence down to the 11th century. So we have four centuries of radio silence. And Athelflaed might seem an exception, but as I say, we've got what we know about Athelflaed, you could write on the back of a postcard. So it is quite hard to sort of, authentically represent women in this period, because they're so badly documented. We can sense they are there because they appear in administrative documents like charters. If you look at the charters issued by kings, their mothers or their wives are witnessing, often from one reign to the next. So they may be exercising great power, but the complexity of their lives is undocumented. Otherwise, they're just ghosts. They're just names on a page.
Yes. And you mentioned the Vikings previously. So my next question is, how was the relationship between the Saxon kings and the Vikings?
Well, not great. I mean, the Vikings kind of, I think, deserve their traditional reputation. You know, they are not, there was a tendency in the, I suppose, from the 1960s onwards to sort of reimagine them as more traders than raiders, you know, and more sort of like, because they had beards and long hair, I think, as kind of hippie types, you know. And actually, you know, it's, I think it does the past a disservice to sort of look at the accounts of atrocities, you know, people being slaughtered, people being led away into slavery, and say, well, this is just hysterical monks, you know, they just don't like the Vikings because the Vikings are heathen. Well, yes, that's very much part of it. They didn't like the Vikings because the Vikings were, in, you know, they were non-Christian, and therefore their violence was directed against Christian sites that Christians themselves would have considered beyond the pale, considered sacrosanct. But they also didn't like the Vikings because they smashed your face in, you know, and they chopped your head off, and they took your the defenseless people away in chains to be slaves. So the short answer is not great. Having said all of that, the Vikings themselves, once they have settled in England, so the Vikings occupy a great swathe of eastern and northern England. As I say, East Anglia, Northumbria and Mercia fall to the Vikings. Alfred claws back or conquers half of Mercia, but everything else to the north and east remains under Viking occupation for several generations. And that means there's a lot of settlement from Scandinavia in those regions. A lot of place names change from Anglo-Saxon, Old English to Scandinavian, Norse. And there's a lot of Viking culture, for want of a better word, in those regions going forwards. Once they've settled, there is quite a lot of bridge building thereafter. So there, you know, by the time you get to the 11th century, although there are still tensions, these regions are incorporated into an expanded Kingdom of Wessex that eventually starts to be called Englelonder, England. So there are these ethnic differences, but they are, you know, by the time you get to the 11th century, they are, you know, conscious that they are a part of a wider whole, and they're starting to think of themselves, the people in those regions, as English, even in the 10th century.
Yeah. But what were the most important events of this time regarding these relations?
Well, Alfred's obviously a very important turning point. I mean, all of England would have fallen to Scandinavian armies had it not been for Alfred. So that's one important turning point. Once Alfred is gone, there's still a very serious existential threat to Wessex from its new Scandinavian neighbours to the north and east. Athelflaed, who we've already mentioned, and her brother, who's King of Wessex, Edward the Elder, they conquer England up as far as the Mersey and the Trent. And then going forward into the next generation, you have Alfred's grandson, Athelstan, he conquers everything north of the River Humber. So you've got Northumbria being added as well. So in a sense, England as it is now is fully assembled by the time you get to the third decade of the 10th century. But what happens then? England in embryo is a great success in the middle decades of the 10th century. But then towards the end of the 10th century, the Vikings come roaring back. There's a new wave of Vikings, and England doesn't do nearly as well, partly because it has an inept king in the form of Ethelred the Unready, who, whatever people might say about him now to sort of try and revise his reputation and say, well, he wasn't that bad, does appear to have had a problem with physically turning up to fight. He seems to have been, for want of a better word, a coward when it came to leading men into battle. there's a low point there. And of course, towards the end of that period, right, as Ethelred lays dying, England is conquered by a Viking king, King Canute. So for the next generation, England, this newly formed unitary state, is ruled by a Scandinavian. So there are, you know, ebbs and flows of Scandinavian power right the way across from the late 8th century right the way through to the 11th century.
Can you tell me about a little bit Æthelstan, who was basically the monarch who united England?
Yeah, well, I can say a little bit about him. I mean, I don't normally say this out loud, but I'm not a huge fan of Æthelstan, only because I think he's had a lot of press, positive press, in recent decades, as this kind of unknown king who nobody knows about. My feeling is now he's quite well known. He doesn't rule for terribly long. He's king from, when is it, 924 to 939. So he has a 15-year reign. And as I've already said, what his achievement is, he builds on the achievement of his predecessors, his grandfather Alfred, his father Edward the Elder, his aunt Æthelflæd, and annexes the north. And he also browbeats the kings and the rulers in the far north of Britain, so the King of Scots, the King of Strathclyde, Cumbria, and the Welsh princes to the west. He physically compels those rulers to bow down before him, to trot into England whenever he demands to attend his council. So although he's rarely styled King of Britain, he's sort of aiming at that prize in terms of his physical power, terms of the extent of his authority. And I think that's the way he's written up by modern historians. The problem I have with kind of heaping so much praise on Æthelstan is he dies in 939, as I've said, and within 3 or 4 years of his death, this overextended empire within Britain has completely collapsed. And by the time you get to 943, there is once again a Viking ruler in York ruling an independent Northumbrian kingdom whose power extends all the way back down to Watling Street, which is where the boundary between English and Scandinavian had lay in Alfred's day. So it's kind of like, to some extent, built on sand, our Æthelstan's power. And it's his successors who are much less famous, people like Eadred, Edwy, Edmund, Edgar, in the middle of the 10th century. They're the ones who build it all up again over the decades to become, as I say, by the time you get to the end of the 10th century, they are actually calling it England, Englander.
Thank you. And my last question, unfortunately, because I could listen to you all day long, but in your opinion, who was the most successful monarch of the Anglo-Saxon period?
Oh, I don't think I could give you an honest answer. I mean, it's tempting to say Alfred, because without Alfred, who knows? You know, Alfred is clearly a very pivotal figure. I mean, there are lots of success stories. Æthelstan's a success story. You know, Canute is a success story. I'm racking my brains to think of a female figure. I mean, Æthelflæd is a success, but if you put it's a kind of fairly fruitless task to try and put them in rank order. I'm trying to think of one who I actually kind of enjoyed doing the most, which is a different question. I have to say one of the things I enjoyed about doing this book was using the Venerable Bede, because you see a lot of these later kings, like possibly with the exception of Alfred, but let's take Æthelstan for example, they're very hard to perceive their personalities because we don't have much in the way of written evidence. It's not what's true of the women in particular is also to a large extent true of the men. I mean, the reason I describe those mid 10th century kings as nondescript is because there are no chronicles of their lives. They occasionally show up as sort of walk on parts in saints' lives, but they're only there for an anecdote or one particular passage. Whereas when you go back to the 7th century, and you've got Bede writing in the early 8th century telling us about the lives of 7th century kings, kings like Penda of Mercia or Athelbert, king of Kent, you know, or the Northumbrian kings like Oswald or Oswin. These are characters that are sort of fully, you know, fully fleshed out by Bede. So we can actually get a lot closer to their lives and their personalities than we can for men and women who live centuries later. So it's not a sort of steady progression, the evidence. It comes and goes. So I think that isn't really an answer to your question, but I did enjoy doing the 7th century stuff.
Okay, thank you so much again for joining me today. Yeah, you can't imagine how grateful I am and how...
Well, it's very nice to be speaking to you. All the best.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and don't forget to subscribe, and you can become a Patreon on patreon.com/historynerdsociety.